Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the Snaggletooth to my Snagglepuss, heavens to Murgatroyd, it's Dan. How you doing this evening, Dan?
I'm doing good. I've had a busy stretch and still fighting off a cold, but it seems like both those things aren't going to be an issue too much longer, so I really can't complain. And you?
Well, I would love to claim I've been busy, but unfortunately not in a traditional sense. I've actually caught a couple movies at home in the recent days. I saw John Wick for the first time this Sunday, and I was pleasantly surprised. That's what you call quite the shoot 'em up. Basically, Keanu Reeves kills the entire, East Coast. No. And I've been enjoying a Blu-ray that I believe someone on this podcast bought me for, was it Christmas? Did you get it?
Yeah. And that feels like that was a long time ago. But,
when my problem seems so small. The sweet smell of success, which I've been, it's one of those movies that I can never recall if I'd ever seen it from beginning to end. Though I felt like I knew the movie so well that I must have. Well, I've kind of watched it, one and three quarters times over the last couple nights, watching with commentary, watching the documentaries. Fantastic film. You don't get more crackling noir-esque dialogue than in that one. So it's been a lot of fun to watch. And I came really close to using the characters from that movie for our introduction, and I realized there is no connection to Hannibal. at least what I said is at least it was a half connection. So maybe for another podcast, a year from now, I'll bring it out of the dustbin and do that. But
Hannibal is kind of a J.J. Hunsaker type. So
yes, everything from the way he cuts people down or looks down on people to his somewhat weird or questionable sexuality. So, yeah, maybe I could have made that connection. But as we're both mentioning, obviously we are here to talk about Hannibal, and namely the, I guess we'd call it the penultimate episode of Hannibal. There has been no notification anywhere that the series will be rescued at this point. So I'm going to assume that there's still always going to be a possibility that they may come back, be it via Netflix or a network or cable as a TV movie or something at some point down the line. But I've pretty much given up hope of anything else until I hear otherwise, since everyone involved has projects lined up that will take up quite a bit of their time, I think.
Yeah, well, hopefully someday we'll get some more. But yeah, I'm definitely treating this as, right before the end.
Yes, I will be referring to next week as the series finale, not the hopefully just season finale. It's a series finale until we hear otherwise. But as we've seen in just over the last few years, there are shows that went bye-bye and then suddenly get a season out of nowhere. I mean, everything from 24 to the upcoming X-Files to Twin Peaks, the rest of development. Jesus, even If Full House can come back, if Coach, oh my God, forget Full House. Full House I knew had a cult following. Coach is coming back. What? I don't know anyone who cared about Coach. Is According to Jim coming back too? What's going on here? The point is, if these shows can come back, I think somehow, some way, Hannibal might resurface at some point. So I'm not going to be too. I'll be depressed next week, but right now I can move on.
Yeah, I guess we can, just try to be happy that we had as much as we did, and that they aired something like that and stupid-ass NBC.
Right, and although it does make me want to not watch NBC for anything anymore, I think we will.
Well, their previews for their new shows, those in themselves make me not want to watch NBC.
Yeah, I say that, though I do know of a couple I probably will be watching, so I can't stick to that. But anyway, we should get on track here. My bad. We are here to talk about, like I said, the penultimate episode, which had one of my favorite titles of the series. Again, we are long past the days of, you know, foreign food titles and such. And the title of this one was a mouthful. It was The Number of the Beast is 666. I like to say it like the old, it's probably before your time. It used to be when you'd call and hear the time, you know, at the tone, the time will be. It should be said that way, I think. I'm rambling.
I've seen that on TV shows or movies. But...
Right. It's 1 a.m. I'm not responsible for anything I say at this point. So let's get to the episode already, since this was an episode that maybe certain people in certain parts of the country might have had to wait a little bit longer than normal to see, because NBC, you know, the nothing but a word I don't want to say, a word that was popular on Deadwood, actually, in their infinite wisdom, chose to preempt Hannibal in certain areas due to, well, it's usually a dog barking on my end, but instead we have a
fucking
cat.
Fucking stop. Name. Yeah, sorry.
Well, it's okay.
My cat got pissy because I, you know, wanted to move my legs and stretch, because, you know, my entire duty while sleeping for 8 hours is just trying to keep the fucking cat comfortable. Well, she didn't like that, so then she like hissed at me and then just jumped on the other fucking cat. Just started biting to the back of his neck. Stupid fucking skank.
All right. And maybe kids in the car listening, leave the cats alone. I'm just kidding. So where was I before we before the cats interrupted? Okay, I was about to talk about the episode, right? Right. Okay. So we're up to The Number of the Beast is 666. So we open the episode when we see the actual painting, the painting of the Great Red Dragon, is coming to life in Will's mind. And we see that he's being further tortured, you know, not just by visions of the victims of the Red Dragon, but he's actually imagining his own wife, Molly, slaughtered, because we see images of her with those mirror shards in her eyes and such. And then we realize this is what he's discussing with Bedelia, who I guess is apparently his therapist now, which is a little strange. But then again, Hannibal being his therapist all that time was quite strange as well. So I guess it kind of makes sense, because I want to say maybe she's the only one who has that sort of an understanding of Hannibal, because I would assume that Alana Bloom is probably a bit more conflicted, you know, based on her physical relationships with both men. But, you know, anyway. So they're having a conversation about those visions. And, oh, I love them mentioning that Bedelia is, you know, she's just another person on Hannibal's fairly long death list. But his promise is to eat her, and considering where Hannibal is, she's feeling perfectly safe. And I gotta say, the moment she said that, or something like that, I don't have the exact words here, I had a thought that I have no idea how they're gonna end the show, though they could be really cruel about it and have the last moment kind of echo Silence of the Lambs a little bit. Instead, we see Hannibal, you know, obviously has gotten free somehow, following Bedelia somewhere and being on the phone saying that he's going to have an old friend for dinner. But actually, it's Bedelia in this case. So I don't think they'll do that, but the thought did occur to me. Because even in this episode, while 90-something percent of it is, if it's lifted from anything, it's from Red Dragon, they do actually incorporate a few things from other Thomas Harris or Hannibal stories. Actually, in this very scene, because when Bedelia is talking to Will about, you know, the fact that Hannibal is essentially in love with Will and wondering if does Will ache for Lecter with the, you know, the same way, and they get this whole conversation about, you know, Bluebeard's last wife, you know, implying that Will may be the final bride or as the show said, murder husband. But the way she's talking about Hannibal and love and everything, it kind of echoes a conversation that happens in the book and movie, I think in the movie as well, Hannibal. Only it's Hannibal talking about Clarice but they use a lot of similar lines here, apparently. So it's, I guess it's Brian Fuller being a little bit cute here, just lifting another bit from another book to use it here.
When they're talking about Bluebeard, what the hell they're talking about?
Okay, I'm amazed that we didn't talk about this before we did the podcast, but I actually was prepared for that question. Yeah. Okay, the story of Bluebeard, he was like this rich crazy guy, and he had all these wives, and when he's up to his, what they call his last wife, she finds out that he had murdered all his wives. I think it's a room or a dungeon or whatever the heck it is, and there's like dead bodies everywhere. It's pretty gruesome. And this is like, you know, it's like a famous, like, I don't know if it's not like a Grimm's fairy tale, but it's that kind of a story, you know. So eventually she kind of conspires with members of her own family to kill Bluebeard themselves. And she ends up, you know, inheriting all this money or whatever. But so that's what, when they make the reference to Bluebeard, that's what they're talking about. A person who has killed his other, who continues to kill all his wives. So that's what they mean here, I guess. Although obviously Hannibal hasn't been married before, but I guess it's anyone he's had any sort of connection with, he then tends to kill, or at least he promises to kill. Since we know he's tried to kill Will and plans to. We know he's promised to kill Alana, and he promised to kill Bedelia. He certainly looked like he was going to kill Jack, even if he didn't promise, but he certainly looked like he was planning to. So that's why I said he must have a very long death list. Chilton, too, I'm sure, though. Well, we'll get to that later. So that's why they make the Bluebeard reference.
Nice.
Okay, so we actually get a little bit of a fancy dissolving, because we transition from that to Lecter talking with Jack Crawford. I gotta say, I want to give props to Lawrence Fishburne here, because I really enjoy, he's doing this measured performance here. And you know, if you're watching the story and the character, that he's probably really working hard to restrain his fury at Hannibal Lecter because of all the games he's been playing, you know, now as well as 3 years earlier and everything else he's done. You know, especially after sending the Red Dragon after Will's family, coupled with all the phone shenanigans and everything else. But I like that Fishburne's able to convey that, you know, with just the expression on his face and the way he delivers his lines. I really kind of enjoy it. Their conversation is almost exclusively, I would say, it's almost spat out in metaphors. But it's also kind of interesting that Jack's manner of deflection, of taking responsibility for anything that has befallen Will, is... because he's equating it by what Lecter has done. But I went, wait, he's defending what he's done by comparing himself to Lecter? So did he just put himself on the same level of culpability as the guy that he considers a monster? Did he just prove his point then? So basically, Lecter's a better debater than Crawford, I think. And their main metaphor in this scene is God, the devil, and the great red dragon. And again, I know I've said this in previous podcasts. Every time they say the great red dragon, I keep thinking they're about to say the great pumpkin. I can't. So I need to eventually do a doodle of like Linus waiting in the pumpkin patch with like maybe the Hannibal mask on, or maybe or with wings for the red dragon or something. I don't know. Anyway. But when they refer to this little trio, Hannibal keeps insisting on another player to make it a quartet, the Lamb of God, they refer to it as. And he refers to the Lamb's wrath being even greater than the great red dragons. Now, I got confused because my first thought when they kept referring to this Lamb, I thought he was talking about Will. And then it occurred to me that he might actually mean the other side of Francis Dalaran, the part of his personality that hasn't been consumed by the Great Red Dragon. I don't know which it is. I think one can make a case either way, but it's interesting that it's kind of, I'm not sure. You know, I'll leave it to others to make their, you know, judgments on that, but I'm not sure which he means or if it's open to interpretation. And also, Jack, he essentially defines Lecter as the devil in that analogy. And I like that Hannibal counters that Jack must be God, and Jack agrees with that. I'm like, okay, so you've gone from equating yourself with a monster, and now you're saying, yeah, I'm God. But what's nice about that is that Hannibal can then note that since Jack and Will both share that same righteousness, he points out that all gods demand sacrifices, which is a nice segue in the episode to going right to seeing Francis Balrog as he's kneeling before his little framed copy of The Great Red Dragon. Never clear if that's just something he ripped out of the magazine that put a frame on, since he obviously destroyed the real painting, or not. And if I hope I said the phrase that this bleeds into that scene, because he really does start bleeding at this point. Because while Francis is, kneeling before that painting, we get this weird mix of real and surreal. Because we alternate between shots of his fingers clawing through his skin on his tattoo, and then an actual image of the painting with blood streaming down the painting. And, we get the dragon as well. And it's a whole amalgam of a whole bunch of things, but it's creepy as fuck.
Yeah, I didn't get the impression that he actually cut himself there, just because he didn't seem to be all tore up later in the episode. So definitely seemed
it's hard to tell with the show. So we have our opening credits, which for some reason this week I decided to tweet about, because I realized that when I watch the credits, they make me think more of cranberry juice than blood, which I probably jinxed myself, because then I ended up with a urinary issue later on, which probably needed some cranberry juice. Anyway, back to the show. Forget that weird digression. So our next scene, we get our lovable trio of Will, Jack, and Alana. And Will is still testy. He's sounding like, they've been discussing using him as bait because he has no other choice. And he's sniping how convenient it is that Jack doesn't have to make the call to do it. But Alana, who again I think has been a revelation since she's resurfaced this season, she kind of cuts through all their posturing and bickering and whatever by saying something that recalls the fact that the other plans that these two have hatched together, they always kind of went awry. I think she said something like, "You once fooled yourselves into believing you were in control of what was happening. Are you still under that delusion?" But then we get a little jolt, because when Will turns to her, his little great red dragon tweaked imagination gives him a vision of Alana with those mirror shards in her eye sockets and the blood streaming down her cheeks. But this, I guess we'll call it this horrifying sight, kind of snaps him into his more pragmatic profiler mode. So then also he starts echoing what Freddie Lowne said to him in that earlier episode about how psychopaths are narcissists and they love to read about themselves. So he tells Jack that they should use Freddie Lowne's and her publication Tattle Crime. By the way, and this won't be the first time I'll say it, I think you'll appreciate this. I kind of thought Will Graham was doing a little bit of a Don Draper here. Not just the fact that they're both people who like to talk to dead people, but he's also stealing someone else's idea without actually giving them credit for it. That's just for the Mad Men people. Too bad for the other people. Anyway, but it does sound, his plan initially does sound a little bit too obvious, because if it's just an article of Will saying, things that are going to upset the Great Red Dragon, that's going to be kind of clearly what he's up to. But thankfully, Alana is there to point out that, that these two guys who have, again, they're not the most skilled at laying traps or serial killers, or seal killers for that matter, but they probably need to get a professional to corroborate what Will would want in that article. And Alana, she's not the sort of fool, and I think she uses the word fool, who'd go anywhere near that kind of a plan, which again gives us a lovely verbal segue to our next scene, where we see our favorite Dr. Frederick Chilton paying Hannibal a visit. So Chilton's kind of pissy. he's none too pleased about Hannibal's most recent article that was written for the North American Journal of Psychiatry. I mean, I like that he notes that, oh, it's brilliantly written, and maybe this might even be his favorite piece by Hannibal. But, which is such a weird thing to say, because then he's really angry that it essentially refutes everything he had written in his book about Hannibal. So, I kind of thought, by the way, it's very funny. When Wiley's wondering why Hannibal's article seems so bitchy and hostile towards him, he actually asks Hannibal if he believes that Chilton is his nemesis. Seeing Lecter stifle a laugh while saying, no, nemesis, no, it reminded me a little bit of something I saw when I was watching an episode of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. You know how he likes to comment on the photo, stock photos, like they're real?
Yeah.
But there's one episode where there's an image of like a 4-year-old dressed as a cop. And he's like, no, I'm not going to take you seriously. No, I'm not under arrest. I thought that's kind of the way Lecter was looking at Chilton when he referred to himself as his nemesis. I went a little far for that one, but whatever. Anyway. But now I can tag this with Last Week Tonight, John Hall. But Chilton, he's especially angry because his book was deliberately filled with lies to help Hannibal, to help his insanity defense, and, you know, save his life. But of course, Hannibal has to get one of his little intellectual quotes in, you know, as a way of, I guess, further elevating his dominance, you know. He has to be a little J.J. Hunsicker on us, I guess. What he says, and I did write down, that wood burns because it has the proper stuff in it. And a man becomes famous because he has the proper stuff in him. You don't have the proper stuff, Frederick. It's a great line. And I did do my due diligence, and I actually looked up who Hannibal was quoting. So for those folks who are literary fiends out there, Hannibal was quoting Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who was a late 18th or early 19th century German writer. He's actually the fellow who wrote Faust that Hannibal had quoted in an earlier episode when speaking to Will. So obviously Hannibal loves this Goethe guy. What makes Goethe interesting, just as a personality, if you ever want to read up on this guy, that he was hugely influential in all fields. This guy was a writer. His poems were set to music by the likes of Mozart, Brahms, and Beethoven. And then years later, he's constantly referenced by all the different fathers of modern psychiatry, like Freud and Jung. That's something.
Oh, yeah, that fucker is like Da Vinci. Like, he did fucking like everything and like awesome at it. So,
figured I would fill in folks who might have been wondering about that. I'm sure like no one was, but I'm telling you anyway. Back to the episode.
Hannibal ended up being wrong too, because, you know, Hill or Chilton essentially was made of wood and had what it took by the end of the episode.
Charred wood. So Chilton tries to then insult Lecter by saying the only reason he ever gets published is due to the freak nature of his byline. And then he shoves the rolled up magazine through one of those round holes in the glass of Lecter's cage. By the way, the moment he did that, my first thought was, there might be staples in that magazine. And I could totally see Lecter pulling a MacGyver and, like, I don't know, murdering someone with a staple or using it to pick something. So I was totally waiting for that in the episode. Who knows? It could still happen in the next episode. So unintentional spoiler. But it was just a thought I had. Anyway, after essentially saying that Lecter's time has passed and that, you know, after Alana Bloom eventually leaves the hospital, I don't know why he assumed that she would eventually leave, he notes that Lecter is going to get tossed into the ward, which I guess is the state hospital's version of Gen Pop, where apparently all the old crazy people get raped. which is like, oh, Chilton's really going for it here. And I like that Lecter he actually gets a slight reaction from Lecter. I would say he glowers at him a little bit. Perhaps mostly at the line that Chilton has here. And it's a really nice line by Chilton, give him credit. how the old ones tend to cry over their stewed apricots. And I'm thinking, you know, that probably bothers him more than the raping. So he then mentions his next book. He says it's going to be called The Dragon Slayer. Once he gets an ending to that story, of course. And he actually leaves a personalized copy of his current book for Hannibal before exiting. And I guess when he leaves, he runs into Alana, who off-screen apparently entices him to be part of that plan with Will and Freddie Lowndes. So then the next scene might have been one of my favorite scenes in the entire episode, where they're all kind of collaborating on the article together. And also, I think we had mentioned weeks ago when I wanted to see more Chilton and I wanted to see Freddie Lowndes, the fact to have them all in the scene together, as well as Will and Jack, it's like, oh, it's like bonus upon bonus. I love having all these characters in one scene together. Especially because this is a show that really, I've noticed it tends to have a lot of just one-on-one scenes. So it's always, I think the show always feels better when we get at least a trio, or in this case, four people in a scene together. Or maybe I'm just ripping off some commentary I heard on The Sweet Smell of Success that I'm thinking about it. I don't know. It's a comment the director makes about his own movie. But in this scene, we find out when Will is, you know, still being snarky towards Freddie Lowndes, he comments how apparently the Tattle Crime sells T-shirts that say the Tooth Fairy was a one-night stand. And what I liked wasn't that. I liked that Freddie offers to get him one. And she says, do you take a small or a medium? And then she says, a small, I think. Which is a very sly shot at that reference she made in their meeting earlier this season, when she mentioned how when they printed the picture of him naked in the hospital, they probably gave him a larger black box to cover up his junk than was probably necessary. I think her saying small was kind of hammering that point home, no pun intended. So we get to the interview, and as Chilton is giving a psychiatric analysis of his thoughts on the Tooth Fairy, because they agree they should call him the Tooth Fairy, because that will continue to infuriate the killer due to the whole, I guess, the homosexual connotation of that title. Will keeps chiming in with these really simplified but really nasty statements that imply that the killer is impotent, that he's and that he's a product of an incestuous home. And I love every time he does it, how Chilton's like, he kind of think he's just like, you might be taking it a little bit too far. And then when they pose by the window, you know, and they do that deliberately so they'll have the killer will have a clear idea exactly where Will is staying. I'm thinking as I'm watching this, I think Chilton's the one who needs to be worrying right now. And I had not seen any stills of the episode that involved what happened in the second half of the episode. And we are going off book at this point, because we're getting to stuff that does not happen in the book. But then when I think in this moment when Will puts his hand on Chilton's shoulder, that was kind of the censure. I was like, oh, yeah, he just made him look like a pet or something. That's not good. Huh. And, you know, right after that, we do see, you know, Dollar-Eyed driving his rapey van, and we see that copy of Tattle Crime on the passenger seat. So obviously it's worked. Now we're just going to be waiting for what's going to happen. And, you know, this is the one part of the episode that's a little bit obvious. When you see, like, Jack and Will, they're walking around the plaza. And they talk about how they have snipers set up and he'll be wearing body armor. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think he's going after you. Huh. And right after that, we see Chilton, you know, leaving wherever he is with two bodyguards and going into an SUV. And we see them both, you know, bink, bink, taking out with these headshots. The very headshots Will references in the previous scene that when he shoots people, he kills them with headshots. And Chilton gets snatched. And then, you know, I think we briefly go to black, and then when we see his gag and blindfold are removed, and there's a little smelling salt, we see that we have gone way off book in every previous film version. Because I think anyone who's read the book or seen any movie version, we all know that in all previous versions, Dolarhyde kidnaps Freddy Lowndes and tortures that reporter and eventually kills him, you know, in a burning wheelchair. But people may recall in the second season, they already kind of faked Freddy Lowndes' death burning in a wheelchair to trick Lecter, if you remember. So they really couldn't do that again. I think that's reason number one. That's like obviously the biggest reason. Part of me also thinks that Fuller and company might have actually felt a little bit more squeamish about having a woman put into such a torturous position, you know, because she would eventually have to be naked and glued to a wheelchair and then everything else that happens. And which becomes more and more horrific as it goes on. I'm not saying that would be why. I mean, obviously what happened in season two is probably the bigger reason, but it did occur to me that they would probably might not want to go that way. Back to the scene. We see Dolarhyde. Oh, he's wearing a robe and he's got that black mask on. I did think, and I think you did as well, the first thought was, oh, he's kind of reminding me a little bit of the way Tom Noonan looked in Manhunter, the 80s version of this story. I think you thought that as well, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Which is interesting because Tom Noonan is built quite differently from a Richard Armitage. He's an oddly structured gentleman, but I think Armitage and his contortions and the way he carries himself does kind of pull that off. He does seem like a much larger person than he actually is. Although I actually have no idea how tall Richard Armitage is. I can't go by the Hobbit movies. That's not fair to him. Because he looks really small in those. So back to this. Obviously, you know, the article had set him off, and that's what led to all this. There's a moment here initially that Chilton is complaining of his back hurting, and the way he's acting as though he actually says as though he's been burned. For a moment there, I was thinking, wait, did he tattoo him?
Yeah, that was my thought.
And I was wondering, like, why would you tattoo him if you glued him to the chair? Because he's obviously never going to be able to see it because he can't move him. And I was thinking, well, it seemed like an odd choice, but since we never find out, I guess it had nothing to do with that. Or maybe the glue was burning him. I don't know. So it became a moot thing. This scene or sequence or whatever, it just is continually escalating tension. It just gets more and more scary for Chilton and for us, because since they've gone off book here, I honestly didn't know where they were going with this. I wasn't sure if they were going to get to, you know, the burning in the wheelchair, because like I said, they did that before, although it was fake, so I didn't know what they were going to do, so it was kind of creeping me out. And then when he swings Chilton around and he pulls his mask up to reveal his mouth, and I was like, oh crap. And then the doorbell rings and we hear Rita. I'm like, okay, I'm again not sure what could happen here, because again, things are not quite the way I remember them from previous versions. But we get what might have been kind of a okay moment became a really amazing moment, you know, between Rita and Frances Dolarhyde, because, you know, she's there because I guess she's trying to reconcile with him. She brought some soup. She'd heard he called out sick, but that's clearly not why she's really there. But I mean, she says a lot of stuff here, but I have to admit, despite whatever eloquence she was using here, it became really hard for me to focus on anything she was saying, because I think you're totally focusing on the fact that in between them in the shot, we're watching Chilton watching them. Because, you know, you keep thinking he's going to make a noise by accident and she's going to catch it, you know, because the whole, or she's going to smell him. Because I realize, you know, Daredevil, right? Don't blind people have heightened sense or something. But that doesn't happen, so she's no Daredevil. So she's actually able to leave for her waiting taxi unharmed, and I guess unaware that there was a man sweating fear by bullets, you know, just a few feet away from her. And then Chilton is then subjected to a slideshow. And you know what I'm going to say now, aren't you? This is no sentimental journey on a carousel with Don Draper kind of a slideshow. That's right. Two Mad Men references. Deal with it. One person I know who doesn't watch Mad Men. she's going to kill me for that. Anyway. The slideshow features, you know, of course, that painting again. And we keep getting these before and after photos of the Red Dragon's victims. And each image is punctuated by him saying, "Do you see? Do you see?" Which, correct me if I'm wrong, that's also used in, I think, both movie versions also. Don't they do that with whenever they torture Freddie Lowndes in both versions?
I don't remember either thing happening.
Let's assume they do.
Yeah.
When I see that, the first thing I think of is, oh, it reminds me of Marathon Man, where he keeps saying, "Is it safe? Is it safe? Is it safe?" While a guy is trapped in a chair being tortured. Maybe that might be an inspiration. Who knows? We finally build through these images to that photo from Tattle Crime, which is implying that Chilton, this is the before picture of Chilton. And that's when Chilton kind of falls apart. Where, you know, gotta hand it to him, he hadn't actually given away the whole thing up until this point. Whereas, even if it was me, I would have been like 5 seconds after waking up, like, no, "I'm not your guy. I'm not your guy. You don't even have to look at me. I'm not your guy." But he says that he was asked to do this by the police. Although by police, I guess he means Jack, because it doesn't ever seem like the police are involved in anything, quite frankly, in any of these things. And that these are Will Graham's lies, not his. But too little, too late. Because, you know, once Francis whips off his mask and I guess everything else, you know, there's very little chance that Chilton's going to be walking out of there. He gives his captive audience a full view of his tattooed back. And then he says a line which, guess what, turned out to be the evening's Twitter hashtag for the show, when he says that fear is not what you owe me, you owe me awe. That was Brian Fuller's hashtag for the episode. All over Twitter. You owe me awe. And then he gives him something which I'm still not sure about. He says, for your journey home, he gives him ice in a thermos. Now, I know what I thought it was used for, but I didn't understand why he would have a thermos of ice for Chilton right then and there. I still don't quite get that. But I'll let it go.
Yeah,
I'll add it to the list of things I don't get. But he wants to tape a video with Chilton first. Because he's done him, oh, yeah, I'll let you go. Yeah, sure. But let's do this first.
And I wonder if thermos, like, didn't actually have ice in it, and it was just, like, you know, whatever flammable liquid that he dumped on him.
That could be it, because, I mean, who knows? Not sure. Mm. So we see them, the beginning of them taping this video, but I realize, oh, this is going to be like Walter White's confession from Breaking Bad. We'll probably be seeing this video later. We're not going to see it now. Yes, now I've gone from Mad Men to Mad Men. That's right. I'm going to take some money from AMC for this podcast. But just when Chilton says, so now that I'm done, you know, I'll be set free now, right? Dolight says, no, well, there's one more thing I want to do. And we see him, you know, from across the room when he starts to put the mask back on, and when he slips in those teeth, I'm like, oh boy. And then they do something interesting, which I do not believe was done in any other version. He kind of creeps across the room, like over the couch towards him. And whether this was a deliberate homage or just entirely coincidental, when you watch him do that, it kind of takes you back to Twin Peaks And when we see Bob kind of come up and creep up over a couch towards the screen, I've actually gone back and watched that, and it's like, wow, it is a little bit similar. That's really weird. I got to think that had to be in somebody's mind when they came up with this.
Yeah, it even has that kind of like the way they like show the movement, where it just feels like it's like the frame rate's just a little like messed up, so it looks a little bit unnatural. So it's definitely,
yeah, and it's very serpentine as well.
Yeah.
And I knew what was coming, and I wanted to look away, but I was thinking, oh, they're probably not going to show it quite that badly, which meant I totally forgot what show I'm watching. And good Lord Almighty, he bites off Chilton's lips. And we see it. We see it in all its horrific, bloody goriness. A friend of mine had commented on this when she was watching it. I'll give her a shout out. Adrian, the one who doesn't watch Mad Men. She was kind of freaked out by the gory nature of it, and I had responded, oh, you watch Walking Dead. It's like, yeah, but, and she mentioned, I'll paraphrase her, yeah, but those are zombies and they're not real. This is different. And I was like, yeah, you're right. It is kind of different. And at least when, like last year, last season, when all the horrific stuff happens to Mason Verger's face, it's done in such a dark room, it's hard to make out a lot of it. You know, in the fact that he ends up eating his own nose or whatever, but it's really hard to see. This wasn't hard to see at all. This was fairly well lit. I was able to see all the viscera and goo and it's pretty bad. So we skip to seeing a package, getting x-rayed, and then getting delivered to Lecter by Alana Bloom. I was extremely confused by this because the package is, well, it's Chilton's lips. Okay. I know this more than most shows we watch. There's a lot of suspension of disbelief with Hannibal. But I'm sorry, any package being sent to Lecter, especially one that they actually x-rayed, that's getting opened before the man gets it. There's no way. There's no privacy. His right to privacy was gone. There's no way it gets x-rayed and the person running the place is giving him a sealed package which has a man's lips in it. There's no way there is no way that happens. I understand it's to help the rest of the scene, but I kept thinking, did the writers find themselves trapped in a corner and they said, who's going to question it? I'm questioning it. But whatever, it's bizarre. And we also get a note with the lips that says, with these, he offended me. So we then cut to later that day, where Lecter is in his traditional straitjacket and he's on that, you know, that huge, I never know what it's actually called. I always call it like the human hand truck, mostly because when I went to a Halloween party in the 90s, I dressed as Lecter and I was wheeled in on a hand truck. So I always think of it that way. One of probably my two best Halloween costumes of all time. we get a weird moment here. Lecter is clearly, this is probably the most amused I've seen Lecter in a scene, other than maybe when he was sitting at that table with Mason Verger, perhaps. He seems to find this whole thing hysterical. And when Jack, he brandishes that tray, but there's only one lip on it now, and he's asking where the other one is, we get that creepy, weird flash of Hannibal kind of staring straight ahead and sucking down the other lip like a reptile or something. You're like a kind of a thing. Again, not to get into the whole suspension of disbelief problem, but wait a minute. Putting aside that whether Hannibal likes his food raw or not, we just saw he clearly must have done that in front of Alana Bloom and probably other orderlies that are there. They know what happened to it. Why is Jack asking? How would this? They didn't leave him alone with the lips, you know. And I'm also going to guess there's probably cameras in that room somewhere. So, again, it's like the whole there's no cameras in the Brooklyn Museum thing. It's like, that's bullshit. Anyway. So, again, then we switch, and this is how we're reminded of how they had already used the element of the burned to death in a wheelchair idea in the previous season. So I didn't know if they'd be able to get away with doing it again, but then I realized they had the perfect reason in place, that the Red Dragon is doing it now as an homage to what they've done before. And I was like, oh, that's how you can get away with this. So anyway, Lecter, like I said, he's downright delighted with what's befallen Chilton. I like when they tell him that they use Chilton to speak to Freddy Lanz in order to enrage the killer, that Lecter congratulates him. Like, you know, he's pretty much like, hey, well done, guys. And he also notes that Alana could have filled the role that Chilton had, and maybe that would have been her lip that he might have tasted. And then he says, again. He's having such a good time. He's even working a little bit of sexual innuendo here. Lecter is just enjoying himself here. And at this point, Alana, who was so great about getting the upper hand on other people in previous scenes in this episode, she fails kind of miserably here with Lecter, because she tries to claim that with Lecter recently humiliating Chilton, that he helped orchestrate his end by proxy. That's some weak tea there, Alana. You know, Lecter's pretty much is right on the money when he's putting the blame right back on you. I like that he refers to it as professional discourtesy. And then we get that trio I mentioned liking so much, Will, Jack, and Alana, and they're watching that video. Unfortunately, it's not the Walter White confession. It actually is Chilton. And he's reciting lines about the Red Dragon and what the dragon will do to Will Graham. And then we see the very beginning of the attack, and which causes Will to grab his head in anguish, kind of in a similar way to the way we've seen Dollarhide react to things, I thought. You know, grabbing his head like he's got a horrific headache or something like that.
Yeah.
And the episode kind of does a full circle thing, coming back to where we kind of started, where we see Will in a therapy session. We're not near the episode, end of the episode, I'm sorry. But Will is back in therapy with Bedelia. And I like that Bedelia kind of makes the point that Will pretty much played a major part in Chilton's what we thought was his demise when he put his hand on his shoulder, which just, it wasn't that an implied trust, but it was obviously done to put Chilton at risk. You know, Will even confesses he can't say he was surprised that happened. And then that's when Bedelia notes that he might as well have struck the match himself. And so also, as she's saying this, we also see images of Chilton being set ablaze. But the reason why this scene is here is because she's pointing out that that's participation. So she's making the point that what Will accused Bedelia of with Hannibal, he's just as guilty. Because during this scene, this is when we finally see that burning body in a wheelchair. But this time it's for real. And we see it like rolling down a path, and it kind of crashes into a fountain. I remember thinking, considering this is a show that everything is staged so beautifully or artistically, at first I was not quite as impressed with how they were staging the body like rolling down this weird little path. But I did get the fact that it was rolling towards a fountain, because that's pretty much what apparently saves his life, I would guess. Because if Chilton doesn't go into the fountain, I think he just becomes a briquette and nothing else. Also, when I mentioned before that it's paying homage, this is all another scheme of Jack and Will that features a burning body in a wheelchair. It doesn't go quite the way they intend. So it's kind of mirroring that as well, I thought. Then after the final commercial break for the episode, Will has another one of his little brief visions of himself literally striking the match to set Chilton on fire. And then we see that he's with Jack, who's actually inaudible at first, but then we realize this is when we actually find out that, oh my God, Chilton is still alive. I was like, okay, I'm sorry. Is he Wile E. Coyote or something? Does nothing kill this guy? Is he just some sort of weird Kafka cockroach or something? How does this guy... this guy should have been dead like 2 years ago. Well, how is he still alive? But he is. I was kind of wondering if maybe they might go get like Mason Verger's medical staff and maybe... do his entire body the way Mason Verger's face was. Because Chilton, when we see him, he basically looks like someone who's left on a barbecue pit for way too long. Which, you know, maybe he'd be tasty for Hannibal now, but I don't know what good he'd be otherwise. But he's not just alive, he's actually speaking. And I like that he's speaking, and obviously his mouth, you know, no lips. It's a little bit hard to understand him, but Will, with his amazing powers, can tell everything he's saying, but Jack apparently can't. So Will has to play translator, and he says, what he's saying is, you set me up, you knew it, you put your hand on me like a pet. And then when they try to get more information, they figure out from Chilton that there was someone else there, a black woman who is blind. And now we have probably the way they're going to be able to track down who the killer is, who Francis Dolarite is, because they can probably narrow down how many black women who are blind who are named Reba in the area. I'm going to guess it's probably not more than, I don't know, one. If there's more than one, that's a really weird town. But sadly, and although we do get, there's a lot of interesting verbal segues in this episode where something or something that's mentioned leads to the next scene. Everything from like Alana saying fool, and then we see Chilton and sacrifice, and we see what's the name, you know, bowing before the painting. Well, when they're talking about Reba, we cut to seeing her bound on the floor of Francis Dolarhyde's van. And he's bringing her to this big house. I don't think we've seen this house before. I initially was wondering, wait, that's not Lecter's place, is it? And then I thought, oh, maybe Dolarhyde's childhood home, perhaps? It's not clarified. I'm assuming we'll know for sure next week. I don't know. But he unties her. He moves her gag. There's this kind of silliness where she's still trying to appeal to what she thinks might be human in him or something when she says, I didn't know you cared this much about me. Let's just be friends and have a good time and forget about all this. I'm like, no, there's no way that's going to work. So he tells her to shut up a few times because this is my favorite part to mock in the episode. I enjoyed it, but I thought it was funny. That he has something important to tell her. He makes it very clear, like, it's very important. It's Sermon on the Mount important. It's Ten Commandments important. I want them to have a reel of him just reeling off all these different things of how important. It's Newton's Law important. It's Gettysburg Address important. It's the first time someone made cheese fries important. It should be all these things. Oh, please let that be on the game. It won't be, but I would have. So then he's trying to, you know, trying to open her eyes, figuratively speaking, because, you know, she's blind. He brings up the events of, you know, what happened in Chicago and Buffalo. I wanted to say, are you talking about football games? What are you talking? Because she clearly doesn't know what he's talking about, because, you know, blind people don't watch the news. So, you know, but he goes further. Because when he starts to name the families and when he talks about how the police think they were murdered, but, you know, they were changed, which I actually got infuriated because I was like, oh, damn it. That means Will was right when he said that a few episodes back. Damn it. Now she starts to figure out what it is he's talking about. And when he says, do you remember what being they said did this? And she starts to say, Tooth Fairy. And he angrily stops her. Think before you answer. And she's like, oh, dragon something. I wanted to reel up a whole bunch of dragon things, like how to train your dragon. You know, is it Game of Thrones? Is that dragon? Oh, red dragon. And then, of course, he has to say, it's the kind of sentence you imagine. It's like every word has a period after it. When he says, I am the dragon, you know. And as he stands before, he's got the whole wings thing and everything going on. And oh, boy, and that's the end of the episode. So hopefully for anyone who might have missed the episode, that was an extensive enough recap for you. So you feel like you watched it all over again, only with a bit of snark. I really like this episode. I think it's a streak of really solid episodes for this whole storyline. And the fact that I can appreciate the fact that they went and did, again, change from the book. It made sense. It was necessary for the story that they're telling. And hey, who doesn't like to see Chilton get almost murdered yet again on the show? What did you think of the episode?
Yeah, it was really good. I've really been enjoying this whole run here, so I'm glad they're finishing up strong. Do you have any predictions for next week? Or 2 days from now, actually?
It feels like they're going to obviously have to do they have to finish up the Red Dragon storyline. Obviously they're coming up with an ending different than anything that I've seen before. So it's kind of bewildering what they're going to do. My guess is that, not to be really generic, but I'm going to say Will is going to kill him, since I don't think they're going to bring Molly into it at this point, because the groundwork just isn't there anymore. So it's going to make more sense for Will to do it. But I got a feeling that's going to happen, and we're still going to get a chunk of episode left, because I feel like they're going to be doing something with Lecter as well in the episode, because I feel that one way or the other, they're going to do something with Lecter by the end of the episode. I don't know if they'll have him be able to escape or not, because I don't know if when they conceived of that episode, if they really felt they would ever get to the Silence of the Lambs storyline or not. It's obviously, if they do, Lecter has to be incarcerated. But I don't know. I kind of feel like they're going to still go out and change that. I would not be shocked to see Lecter free at the end of the series, which would be, talk about big changes. That would be the biggest change of all. But again, it may be simply them taking an element from Silence of the Lambs and using it here instead. I'm not saying I want them to do that, but I can really see them doing that. You have any thoughts, or are you just wiped out from the lateness of the hour?
Yeah, I'm pretty wiped out. But I don't, even if I wasn't, I don't know if I have much predictions for it.
I do have another possible prediction, that it's going to end with Hannibal sitting in a lotus-like yoga position on a mountainside, and then we're going to segue to a commercial for Coke. I kid. No, it's going to end with Hannibal dying and staring straight up at the camera as the camera moves. Oh, wait, no. That's been done in too many different shows now. We'll see what happens. I'm looking forward to it. If this was any other network in any other situation, I'd be like, oh, maybe they'll give us a 90-minute. But, at this rate, it wouldn't shock me if NBC decided to preempt it. So let's just hope there isn't another preseason football game on next Saturday. Although I haven't checked the listings. I don't even want to, because I'll just be infuriated. But it feels like they're ending strong, and that's all we can hope for at this point. And, be happy we got what we got.
Yeah.
All right. So, if you got a chance to listen to this podcast and you enjoyed it and you would like to talk about Hannibal or any other TV show, or anything else you have on your mind that's, you know, pop culture movie related, you can do so on our Facebook page. Track us down there, the Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can like the page, join the page, and join the conversation. You can also find us on iTunes if you didn't find us that way already. Just type in Serious TV or Serious TV Drama in the search box. We will come up as pretty much the first or maybe only suggestion, which is convenient. So you can find us there. Subscribe to us there. We'd love to have subscribers. And if you did enjoy this podcast, you can rate and review us there. You can also, therefore, find our previous podcasts, which aren't all about Hannibal. We talk about geeky stuff in other podcasts, or Mad Men, or pretty much anything, whatever we get a chance to get together and talk. Right. So, we've got the last episode to look forward to next week, which will be titled The Wrath of the Lamb. Again, I guess we'll find out in that episode just who the Lamb is. I'm hoping for a special surprise cameo appearance by Jodie Foster, but probably not her. And until then, I don't know. Bon appetit.